and welcome to the MVP, the Mass Violence Podcast, the official podcast of the National Mass Violence Victimization Resource Center. I'm Jeff Hartle, Public Information Director for the NMVVRC, and I'm really excited about today's episode. We're going to be talking about how the FBI's Victim Service Division has evolved over the last decade, particularly how they respond to different mass violence incidents. In this episode, we will also hear from two guests as they reflect on their collaborative effort in the 2002 article titled Post-Terrorism Services for Victims and Surviving Family Members, which was in response to the Pan Am Flight 103 bombing in Lockerbie, Scotland. Joining me today are Dr. Dan Smith, Director of Technology and Resources at the National Mass Violence Victimization Resource Center, and Catherine Turman, recently retired former Assistant Director over the FBI's VSD, or Victim Services Division, from 2002 to 2020. A little bit of background on the FBI VSD. Catherine Turman was responsible for developing the FBI VSD, starting with just six staff and now consisting of almost 300 victim specialists, terrorism victim services coordinators, child adolescent forensic interviewers, child victim services specialist, and an international hostage family engagement team and operational psychologist. Prior to joining the FBI, Ms. Turman served in the Department of Justice as director of the Missing and Exploited Children's Program, chief of the Victim Witness Assistance Unit in the United States Attorney's Office for the District of Columbia, and director of the Office of Victims of Crime, or OVC. While serving as the OVC director, Ms. Turman was tasked by Attorney General Reno with developing a comprehensive plan to ensure that every family member that lost loved ones in the 1988 bombing of Pan Am Flight 103, regardless of nationality, were afforded opportunities to follow and participate in the Scottish trial of two Libyan intelligence agents held in the Netherlands. As a result of her work with Pan Am 103 and the Lockerbie families, Ms. Turman received the Edmund J. Randolph Award, the highest honor provided by the Department of Justice. Ms. Turman, thanks for being here.
Well, thank you very much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here with you.
I would like to begin with you, and am curious as to what was the first mass casualty or mass violence event that you remember responding to?
My knowledge and understanding of mass violence actually begins with an event that occurred 17 years before I was born. I came at this issue from sort of an unusual path. I grew up in the shadow of one of the worst mass fatality crimes in the U.S., and that was the explosion of a school in New London, Texas in 1937 that killed 294 students and teachers. The explosion was caused because administrators heated the school by illegally tapping into waste gas from nearby oil fields. The explosion shattered windows in my hometown, 10 miles away. Many people from the area rushed to help pull victims out of the rubble, including some of my own family members. None of them ever forgot the sight of the broken bodies of so many children or the faces of parents as they walked among the bodies trying to identify their own children. Most of the kids in that community perished in the small town of New London, withered away as families moved away. There were hearings and new laws for natural gas safety, but nothing for the families except compassion and prayers in the immediate aftermath. After that, everyone knew about it, but no one talked about it until the 50th anniversary in 1987. Finally, survivors began to tell their stories to journalists. When I worked at the Justice Department some years later, I met a woman whose husband lost his cousin in that explosion. Every summer during her husband's childhood, his parents made him travel to spend a month with his aunt and uncle. His aunt called him by his dead cousin's name, made him dress in his cousin's clothing, and would sit by his bed at night watching him. I was struck, as I learned more about the New London school explosion, by how the silence around this event for so many years and the lack of support impacted the families and survivors, not just then, but for multiple generations. In 1988, I was working on Capitol Hill for a U.S. senator when the bombing of Pan Am 103 occurred. We knew some of the victims and the father of another. There was an initial outpouring of support for the grieving families, a lot of collective rage against the unknown perpetrators and hearings, and a presidential commission on aviation security and terrorism. But there was nothing really in place from the U.S. government to help even the American families, much less the families of victims from 20 other countries. The people of Scotland were compassionate but had little to offer in terms of victim services. The President's Commission included a recommendation to establish a compassionate payment program to help compensate families, but it never went anywhere. Senator Hines was a member of the earlier President's Task Force on Victims of Crime, and he noted the systemic lack of support for victims of terrorism that occurred outside the United States. Unfortunately, he died in a plane crash in early 1991 before his efforts could bear fruit. During my time at the Justice Department, I responded to several multi-victim shootings in D.C., including the murders of employees in the Georgetown Starbucks. Later at OVC, I was involved in the ongoing efforts for Oklahoma City bombing victims, the shootings at Columbine and other schools, the bombings of the Khobar Towers, the U.S. embassies in Kenya and Tanzania, and the U.S. guest Cole. And then, of course, then came 9/11. So my earlier experiences certainly shaped my thinking about responding to victims of mass violence, mostly recognizing that there needed to be a thoughtful, meaningful, and sustained plan for assisting victims and families.
Absolutely. You listed a lot of mass casualty events there. You know, we know each crime is different and brings its own unique challenges. From your perspective, what are some of the major differences or challenges that differentiate between the response to a large-scale mass casualty crime and a crime that affects a smaller number of people?
Well, certainly the number of victims and the scope of the event can seem overwhelming. It can seem overwhelming from emotionally and psychologically, but it can actually be overwhelming in terms of the ability of agencies and organizations to respond. These events tend to involve a great deal of violence. Often, if they're high impact events, fragmentation of remains, a lot of violent imagery, including these days, so many things are recorded. People have their cell phones. There are other recordings. People make phone calls. Victims do. So they just the scope and the ability to actually respond and just the level of violence and the time it may take in some events to actually identify victims and get support for the families. Most communities are resourced for smaller events, but they lack the capacity to sustain a longer and larger response. What I've found is lots of people rush to help, but not all help is the same or is needed at the same time. Managing staffing and resources is incredibly challenging, especially if a community doesn't have a robust plan that clearly identifies partners, what they bring to the table, and how it's all coordinated. In so many of the events that I've seen, the local victim services people respond, but then after the first 24, 36 hours, they're exhausted. Who's coming in their place? Who, you know, there just aren't in many communities the depth of people who can respond, because those first 5 to 7 to 10 days, sometimes 2 weeks or more, it's extremely wearing on the people who are responding.
Sure, sure. When the Lockerbie trial happened, you had a leadership role in the Office for Victims of Crime in the Department of Justice. Tell us a little bit about what you remember about how the federal response to that incident, which obviously occurred overseas, came about.
It was an unforgettable experience, actually. Over the years since I left Senator Hines' office, I had followed sort of the story of the Pan Am 103 Lockerbie case, the investigation, the families. I had met a number of them when I worked on the Hill and had run into or had contact with a few of them over the years. And I'd heard from some of the FBI agents involved that they were working on an agreement. The UN was brokering an agreement between Libya and the government of the United Kingdom in the U.S. to hold a Scottish trial in a third country, a neutral country. That was necessary before the Libyan government, Gaddafi, would hand over two of the indicted subjects for that. So I was aware that that stuff was going on, and I got a call in April of, I think it was 99, when the two Libyans were handed over to the Scots and transported to the Netherlands to this site where there would be a trial. So that day, I got a call from Attorney General Reno's office asking me to come over to the office that she wanted to talk about the Lockerbie trial. So I walked in and there's Deputy Attorney General Eric Holder and Secretary of State Madeleine Albright. And they said, "You've heard what's happened?" "Yes, I've heard." And they said, "Well, TAP, you're it. Basically, we are contributing, the U.S. government is contributing resources, staffing, evidence to support the Scottish trial. Scotland doesn't really have a robust victim services structure. So part of our contribution, the U.S. government's contribution, is going to be support for the families of the victims, not just the American families, but all of the families from the other 20 countries. So that was really unprecedented. So I left her office, you know, with her promise that, you know, let me know, I'll be in touch, whatever you need from me, I'll do. And went back to my office and thought, oh my God, what, how are we gonna do this? This is a trial that may last 1 to 3 years, held in a third country where none of the victims actually lived or were from, under Scottish law, which even under Scottish law was going to be unusual. It would not be a jury trial. It would be a special trial with a panel of high court judges. So I immediately linked up with the rest of the American team supporting the trial. I started reaching out to families. I went to one of the family meetings, family group meetings, told them what was going on and just listened to them and started calling people. I had other people in OVC working with me who reached out to families. What do you want to see with this trial? What do you expect? Many of them talked about what had been done for the Oklahoma City bombing families in terms of providing support for them to watch the trial, either to go to Denver for a week and be in the courtroom or watch it from a remote viewing site. Shortly after that, the rest of the U.S. team, which included FBI, DOJ, Marshals Service, CIA, and we all trekked over to the Netherlands, saw the trial site, began discussions with the Scottish court, the prosecutors, the judges, and then went back to Scotland and London for meetings with the Foreign Office and with other entities that were going to be involved in the trial. The investigation took place in 70 countries. There were a lot of people who were involved in the investigation and in the evidence. So,
wow.
I came back and put together a plan for Ms. Reno. She liked it, supported it. I presented it to the Crown Office in Scotland, the Solicitor General, and ultimately the Lord Advocate, who was their Attorney General. And part of the plan included a remote broadcast of the trial to the United States and the United Kingdom. And I'd been told there's no way, no way, this very conservative Scottish judiciary, who still wear the robes and the white wigs, are ever going to agree. There's never been a camera, even a still camera, allowed in a Scottish court. Well, dang, if they didn't come back and say, yeah, we'll support it. Yeah, we'll do it. You make it happen. So it was an opportunity to really kind of push the envelope. Ms. Reno went to the Hill. There was a lot of support, from bipartisan support, from many different senators and congressmen. They passed special legislation on an appropriations bill that basically gave OVC kind of a blank check to provide whatever assistance was necessary. So we did everything from, we went to Syracuse University and talked to the dean of the law school there. They were going to do a web page or a website on the trial, since Syracuse lost 35 students. So their international law professors set up this website for us, for the families. The Scottish court was able to plug in or use really advanced, at that time, technology for simultaneous transcription in the courtroom. So as people spoke in the court, it automatically transcribed what they were saying. At the end of the day, a court reporter would make corrections. They would email it to us. We'd email it to Syracuse University. They would post it on a website for the family. So no matter where they were in the world, the day of the trial, or by at least the next morning, depending on their time zone, there would be the transcript of the day before's proceedings, and a summary by the law professors at Syracuse.
Amazing.
Yeah, we provided opportunities for families to travel to the trial for a week. About 500 took advantage of that. We had 4 remote viewing sites, which were actually extensions of the Scottish court. One in Scotland, one in London, one in Washington, and one in New York. And those were heavily attended by families, particularly from those areas. We provided access to mental health services. and some funding for people, because the trial, even 12 years later, reignited a great deal of trauma and loss. And we made it as easy as possible for these families to participate in this long-awaited opportunity for some justice and accountability.
Sure.
So it was quite an experience. The international collaboration was amazing. It was one of the most satisfying experiences I've had in my career, because the Scots, the Brits, all the other people involved were extraordinarily collaborative and interested and very supportive of the families and what we were trying to do for them.
That is very impressive, collaborating with different countries, obviously the family members. That is amazing work. Speaking of collaboration, when the trial of the suspected bombers took place, you collaborated with some folks here at MUSC, including our other guest, Dr. Dan Smith, in evaluating the services that were provided to the family members. How did that collaboration come about?
Well, there was a small group of us in OVC who were trying to deal with this extraordinary effort while at the same time the rest of the office was going on. And I was familiar with the work of Dr. Kilpatrick and the center there. Because this effort to support the victims through this unique trial was so unusual and kind of unprecedented, and we were spending a good bit of money on it, we wanted to find out, you know, whether what we did was valuable, whether it made a difference, whether it was feasible for the future, what we could learn from it. And most of all, we wanted to learn from the families themselves about their earlier experiences and then how they fared during the trial and how the services helped them, if they did help them. So it was really kind of a no-brainer to reach out to the organization there and say, you know, can you do this for us? And they did a great job. We learned an awful lot. I think including the earlier experiences of the families was particularly helpful. It really showed us the contrast between the first 11 years of their experience and then what they were able to get from the trial. And there were so many things that came up during the trial that none of us expected. One was the fact that so many families have questions about how their loved ones died. They want details. They want things that, and in the immediate aftermath, they often don't know who to ask, or they're just in shock and don't think about it. But persistent questions may sort of last for years. So we were able, in an amazing number of cases, to answer questions from families about things that had troubled them for years. And the second day of the trial, a police officer who had testified about the scene and finding some of the evidence and bodies came off the stand, and it was a break. And he came up to me and said, could you tell me if this one family is here? He said, I found their twin sons' bodies. And he said, I've waited 12 years to talk to them, basically.
Oh, my.
That couple was there, and we put them together in a room. I sat with them. And he was able to tell them, you know, how their sons, who were identical, inseparable in life and in death, you know, how they were found. And it meant so much to the parents, to that family, to hear that. And that happened a number of times over the course of the trial, where we were able to give them information. Some witnesses testified. One testified about, she was the gate agent at Heathrow Airport. She was the last person to see the victims as she put them on the plane and closed the door. And she was able to share memories of the atmosphere in the boarding area. It was a Christmas flight. People were going home for Christmas. They were happy. The kids, college kids, were playing guitars, and people were, you know, bringing presents and stuff. So to be able to hear that kind of information all those years later was bittersweet, but really appreciated.
Sure, sure. Those are some fascinating and powerful stories there. Dan, I'd like to bring you in and ask you, you know, what did the results of the program evaluation tell us about how best to help family members of international terrorism events?
Great question. And I think the best answer to that is to try and do so as quickly as possible and with as much information as possible which, as Catherine has described extensively, the government wasn't really allowed to do or didn't really have the infrastructure to do at the time of the bombing. And it was only through the efforts of government officials, Congress, and so forth that created legislation that allowed OVC to serve mass violence victims overseas 11, 12 years later. So one of the harder things about designing this evaluation project was to try and not ignore the fact that for the first 10 or 11 years after the bombing, nothing happened. No services were provided, and there was no coordinated governmental response for the families. And then to recognize that at some point, as we've heard, OVC led this massive international collaboration to provide services that were in some ways, you know, probably incredibly welcome, but also in some ways too late to affect some of the more immediate needs. And what we found was kind of exactly that, that for the first 10 or 11 years after the bombing, satisfaction with government response or non-response really was very low, but that once OVC got involved, the families were incredibly appreciative, really enjoyed the information that they were provided. We asked the family members that we were in touch with whether they'd ever used any of the various services that OVC provided for them. And, you know, 30% had traveled actually to the trial court. 75% had consulted the trial handbook explaining what was going on in this Scottish system that was unfamiliar to most U.S. citizens. 42% traveled to attend the trial. 60% used the secure internet website. And, you know, one of the more, from my perspective as a mental health professional, one of the more disappointing things was OVC went to great lengths to try to provide funding for mental health counseling. And only 6% of the families that we spoke to actually ended up using that funding to seek counseling. And there are a number of reasons for that, having to do with access to trained counselors and awareness of the funds and so forth. But the take-home message from our perspective was really, A, what a massive thing OVC did under Catherine's leadership here to make these services available, that the information services were just absolutely devoured by the families. They were so desperate for information. And of course, the kind of summary statistical information that I can share with you pales in comparison to the emotional impact of the scene that Catherine described with the family listening to circumstances about how their twin sons were found, of course, but that also greater attention really needs to be paid to making sure that the mental health needs of victims and their families are recognized and that there's greater awareness about the availability of those services for folks who need them. And just to sort of put this in some historical context, we were doing and publishing this survey. This article came out describing the program evaluation just a few months after 9/11 happened. So there were some real lessons to be learned from what OVC was able to implement for the Lockerbie trial and the affected families, and how that we could pass on that learning in the response to 9/11.
Understood. Wow, that's fascinating statistics that that you saw with the survey or the results that became the published article. And the collaboration between the two of you must have been, a lot of communication.
Yeah, I was a much younger man in those days, and was invited onto this project to help see it through. But the heavier lifting and the larger conceptual planning happened between Dean and OVC under Catherine's leadership at that particular time. But it was a formative experience for me to learn about how to assist victims' families in ways that were meaningful and appreciated following such a disastrous event. I mean, I remember where I was when I heard about the Lockerbie bombing. I was sitting in the kitchen with my mom at home, home from college, and hearing about these Syracuse University students who would never make it home to do exactly what I was doing at that particular time. And it was really kind of a full circle moment to be involved in a process that helped bring support and some degree of closure to the families who were affected by this tragedy.
Sure, sure. Ms. Terman, as we move forward here, I'd like to kind of shift gears a little bit and talk to you about your FBI career. I know when you started at the FBI, the agency didn't really have a well-established victim services division. And basically, you were responsible for building the VSD from a small team to what it is today. Can you share with us some of the challenges in that process, along with some of the accomplishments that you are most proud of?
Yes, thank you. It was quite an experience. When I worked at OVC, one of the questions that I got from Ms. Reno routinely was, "Catherine, why can't the FBI do this? What they seem to have a hard time getting the knack of doing victim services. They don't seem to put a high priority on it." So I used to write her memos. She used to ask for these memos with my insight into that. So fast forward to 9/11, I guess it was, I'd seen, first of all, I worked with Robert Mueller, Director Mueller, for many years. I knew him in the early 90s when he was head of the criminal division. I was running the Missing and Exploited Children's Program. Then we were both at the U.S. Attorney's Office. He was chief of homicide. I was chief of the Victim Witness Assistance Unit. And then he came back to justice with the Bush administration as acting deputy attorney general, and then became the FBI director. So I knew him already. So I saw him the night of 9/11 because I ended up, along with one of my folks from OVC, in the FBI's operations center, and would see Bob off and on during that time. And he would always ask me, "How are the victims doing? What can we do?" But just not in a place yet to really think long-term. But surprisingly, by the 1st of November, he was asking questions and had a consulting firm actually evaluate the FBI's approach to victims. And they came back with a pretty dismal report. That December, right before Christmas of 2001, he called me and ask if I would come over to the FBI and run this new office he was going to create for victim assistance. And it's hard to say no to Bob Mueller. He's very persuasive. And I felt like, well, I complained for so many years about the FBI. It serves me right. Now I have to be the one to go over and try to help make this work. So it was great. I had his very strong support. At times I had to ask him to back off a little bit because I didn't want to, he could be heavy-handed sometimes, but he was extremely supportive. He had high expectations for the program. I asked him, "What do you expect?" And he said, "I want a professional victim assistance program. I want you to be able to do for 9/11 and other terrorism victims what you did with the Pan Am 103 case and the trial." So I started on January 4th with the staff that I'd inherited from the asset forfeiture unit. Only one person actually had victim assistance experience. They assigned an agent from Oklahoma who I had met and liked, and so he worked with me for the first few years. So we were literally drinking from the fire hose, trying to get the FBI's response to 9/11 victims kind of put together, dealing with some personal effects issues. One of the first things Bob asked me to do was assess whether or not I thought we should play the cockpit voice recorder from Flight 93. United Flight 93 for the families. It was the only cockpit voice recording that survived the four flights, and it was going to be used in the trial against Musawi. So the director wanted the families, he didn't want them to hear it for the first time in a court. So we did end up playing that. And then we had the Iraq and Afghanistan conflicts. We had terrorist attacks, you know, in Pakistan and Bali, all over the world. So we were trying to respond to those and build a program at the same time. So part of the challenge in the FBI is, and law enforcement can be kind of a tough culture anyway, in the FBI, even more so, because they just weren't accustomed to the idea of victim services. So the initial response I got from some people was, you know, this is a boondoggle. We don't need social workers. We don't hug people in the FBI. I had some, you know, people sort of complain to me. I had one agent tell me, we don't need some alfalfa chewing Birkenstock wearing social worker coming in here and telling us how to do our cases. So my response was, first of all, I haven't seen any of them chewing alfalfa. And the other thing is, they're not going to try to run your case. They just want to make life easier for the victims and ultimately for you, so you can focus on your job. So I talked to a lot of agents around the country. I invited their responses. I got an earful, a lot of good stuff and some negative, but I asked them, what is it that you need help with most? What do you see with the victims in your cases that you think is important? Where do you think their needs are? So I looked at the law, what was required for federal victims of crime. I said, talk to the agents, and then pull together. We had started hiring some victim specialists and child interviewers by then, pulled that group together and started developing some standards, some program requirements and standards. And then we created position descriptions and started hiring. And we were able to bring on 112 people ultimately. It took some time, but we put them in the field offices, and we looked for people that we thought could deal with the law enforcement culture. They had to be fairly tough. They couldn't be too precious. They had to be able to take sort of a lot of resistance sometimes. Many agents were extremely supportive, particularly the ones in Indian country who welcomed them. But it was up to each victim specialist to really sort of prove their worth in their office, to show the agents that what they could bring to the table, what they could bring to victims would ultimately help the victims, help their cases, and help their own satisfaction in their job. A lot of agents did express real frustration that they saw what happened to victims. They saw their needs and felt frustrated because they didn't have a way to help them. So we went from sort of that initial resistance over time to a point where I had a really experienced, very sharp agent say to me, you know, I had a lot of skepticism when you started this program, he said, but now, he said, I cannot imagine sending our agents out to a crime scene without a victim specialist there, no more than we would think about sending agents without the evidence response team as well. So it took a number of years, and it took really good people doing really great work, and it did change, and it made it easier for us to get additional resources over the years. I think now they're up to about 30 forensic child interviewers scattered around the FBI and close to a couple of hundred or more victim specialists. So I think the program was fairly innovative in a lot of ways. We had to respond to a lot of federal crimes that were sort of on the cutting edge. You know, there were things that a lot of local police departments and local victim service providers didn't necessarily have to deal with. So we created a special terrorism and special jurisdiction unit. We hired a forensic pathologist, a former actually medical examiner's investigator, to be our liaison to the Armed Forces Medical Examiner's Office, where terrorism victims' bodies would go and with families, and to help them understand autopsy reports. And that was sort of a unique role that I haven't seen in any other places really, except medical examiner's offices, but it was extremely helpful.
And if I'm correct, I believe you were also responsible for bringing canines to the team as well.
Yeah, I was actually invited to speak at a victim services conference in Alberta, Canada, And there were 900 or so victim service professionals from the provinces, mainly Alberta, but some others. And two of the agencies that were represented there had crisis response canines. And I thought it was great. I fell in love with the program and heard the stories of how these dogs helped with victims. So I came back and talked to my boss at the time, a guy named Bob Anderson, and told him, you know, what I'd seen and what we wanted to do. And he said, heck yeah. He said, I'll support it. He said, how much is it going to cost? So I said, this is what it would cost for one dog. We've identified a couple places. And he said, well, don't just get one, get two. So we went to Assistance Dogs of the West and were able to get two labs, Wally and Geo, and train handlers in our office and bring them in. And they were wonderful. They've made a real difference. They were, I think Wally or Geo was the first dog allowed in a federal court as a support animal, you know, for this kind of purpose.
Interesting.
Yeah. And they often accompanied children and other victims into court. Mass casualties, they were particularly helpful. I remember one situation, one event where there had been a young man, an adolescent who had seen a number of his friends killed and shot and was coming to the family assistance center, but almost catatonic. He really wasn't talking, wasn't interacting. And he was sitting down and Melody came in with Geo, and Geo went right to him immediately, put his head on this kid's knee, and everything just broke. The dam broke there. And that kid was able to finally cry and respond, and he would come back every day and spend time with Geo. I've seen it happen with families of hostages who've been beheaded, you know, where the dogs just are able to provide a measure of comfort that humans can't. So it's a very valuable program. I think they're looking to expand it, and I would recommend it because there is that connection with animals and most people that is quite special.
Absolutely. Absolutely. That's a great story, and appreciate the innovation there to recommend bringing the canines on board. Finally, as we, reflect back on your incredibly influential time in government service, you've shared a lot of stories so far, and it's absolutely incredible. Directing federal victim assistance efforts for victims of large-scale mass casualty events, I can't think of anyone with a better perspective to address this last question. And that is, what do you think should be the future of victim assistance efforts for mass violence?
You know, it's the answer to that question has become more challenging in recent years. In the past, we used to have 2 to 3 major mass violence events a year. And now there are probably that many within a month across the United States. And many of these events are motivated by hate, and they target particular populations. They have a broad impact on the community. Collectively, we've learned a lot about how to respond and help, but we need to spread that knowledge, particularly since these events are becoming more and more commonplace, unfortunately. We have to keep doing what many agencies and communities are doing, but find ways to do it even better and to have more of it, more resources. I think it would be helpful to create more skilled response teams that can help guide and support affected local communities. Sometimes these events happen in large cities where there are a lot of resources for victims. And many others happen, and when I was in the FBI, a lot of the cases our victim services response team, our national response team responded to, were in communities, a few that had no victim services. They didn't even have a domestic violence shelter.
Oh, wow.
So, you know, you have to sort of tailor the response to the communities, but, you know, ideally, I think it would be great if every state had a crisis response team made up of, you know, agencies and other organizations who could respond and support communities. As I mentioned before, the first 5-7 days are incredibly difficult and challenging and require a lot of people. even just doing death notification. And we've seen situations where death notification was done very badly and some where it was done very well. But it all depends on whether you have enough people who are trained. And if there aren't enough trained people, I've seen agencies tap officers and other people who don't have that experience. And they end up kind of botching the death notification. And that really sets the tone for many families for how they're going to feel about the people who are trying to help them after that. So when something happens in the FBI, we used to send our local victim specialists to help support if they were needed, the local folks. And what we saw every time was after the first 24, 36 hours, as I said before, people are worn out. And where's the backfield? Where's the next group of people coming? So do you have mutual aid agreements? Do you have common training on death notification and how to manage a family assistance center? So, you know, I know there are things like the center there at the Medical University of South Carolina that's doing a great deal to put out information, make information and training and things available to people all across the country and the world in terms of how to respond to these things. I think it's really important, too, to make it easier for survivors and families to find relevant specialized mental health services. Mental health services vary greatly across the country. There are people who are really knowledgeable about trauma and then others who don't. That's not what they do. And everywhere I go in all of these events, there's always a challenge in finding and funding mental health services and keeping them going for as long as people need them. I think it also would help to educate employers about the impact of mass violence events so that survivors and families can get the time off that they need, and also whatever support they can get from their employers. You know, I don't know. Part of the problem, too, is there is money available. There's money from VOCA for mass violence response. There's the Compassion Fund. There are other fundraising efforts that happen in the aftermath. I think we've learned a lot about how to manage those kinds of funds, but I think there's still a lot of work that needs to be done to make funding available when people need it and for the right things and to do it in a fair and equitable way. And I think also we just need to really look at the sort of the long-term impact. Most of our services are set up for short-term. And I think some families and victims will need additional assistance going forward. One of the other things that I would mention is all of this is happening and people are preparing and responding. And maybe it's because of the hat that I wore in the Justice Department and the FBI, but I think there really needs to be strong collaboration between non-governmental agencies who are responding and the role of law enforcement and prosecutors, particularly law enforcement, because there's going to be responsibilities that they have that no one else can do. The identification of victims, death notification, identifying and returning personal effects, which can be very challenging, and then providing information about what happened to families. They're the only people who can have those answers and can provide that information. And being able to sort of identify when families are seeking that information and helping them access it, working with law enforcement or prosecutor's offices, whoever, or sort of maybe a medical examiner, to try to get the information to them is important. One of the things I learned in the FBI is that there's a lot of information that is collected as part of a murder investigation that has evidentiary value, but there's also a lot of information that doesn't have evidentiary value, but has invaluable meaning to families. Just like some of the things we were able to do with Pan Am 103, stuff we did with 9/11, with other cases where 19 years after 9/11, I was still answering questions from family members who had very specific questions. Do you know where my husband was in the building when he died? Do you know where he was going? So I think it's just really important to realize that I think information is very important to families. There have been some studies by the Department of Defense and others that say that information about the death details for those family members who seek it is really important to be able to provide to them and to do it in a way that's very sensitive and supportive. So lots to do to manage. And as I said, one of the greatest challenges is just the fact that these events are coming so fast.
Unfortunately, they are. They are. And it's, you know, very important, obviously, that, you know, we have the Victim Service Division and victim assistance for the family members. It's an invaluable resource. And I appreciate the stories that you've shared with us and your experiences. And you've had a remarkable career. And we are grateful for your time and joining us today for the MVP podcast.
Thank you. It's been my pleasure.
All right. Well, this has been another episode of the Mass Violence Podcast, the official podcast of the NMVVRC. And thank you for listening.